"Who's Claire McCaskill?" I'll say, amazed that I, that anyone, for that matter, could have such an ignorant boyfriend. I knew that the Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage was expected at 10 a.m. on June 26th, which is 3 p.m. in Sussex. I'm usually out then, on my litter patrol, so I made it a point to bring my iPad with me. When the time came, I was standing by the side of the road collecting trash with my grabber. It's generally the same crap over and over, potato chip bags, candy wrappers, Red Bull cans. But along this particular stretch, 6 months earlier, I'd come across a strap-on penis. It seemed pretty old and was Band-Aid colored, about 3 inches long, and not much bigger around than a Vienna sausage, which was interesting to me. You'd think that if someone wanted a sex toy, she'd go for the gold, size-wise, but this was just the bare minimum, like getting AAA breast implants. Who had this person been hoping to satisfy? Her Cabbage Patch doll? I thought about taking the penis home and mailing it to one of my sisters for Christmas, but knew that the moment I put it in my knapsack, I'd get hit by a car and killed. That's just my luck. Medics would come and scrape me off the pavement. Then, later, at the hospital, they'd rifle through my pack and record its contents. 4 garbage bags, some wet wipes, 2 flashlights, and a strap-on penis. "There must be some mistake," he would tell them. "You said it was how big?" My iPad could get no signal at 3 p.m., so I continued walking and picking up trash, thinking that whichever way the Supreme Court went, I never expected to see this day in my lifetime. When I was young, in the early 70s, being gay felt like the worst thing that could happen to a person, at least in Raleigh, North Carolina. There was a rumor that it could be cured by psychiatrists, so for most of my teens, that's where I placed my hope. I figured that eventually I'd tell my mother and let her take the appropriate steps. What would kill me would be seeing the disappointment on her face. With my father, I was used to it. That was the expression he naturally assumed when looking at me. Her, though. Once, when I was in high school, she caught me doing something or other, imitating my Spanish teacher, perhaps with a pair of tights on my head, and said, like someone at the end of her rope, "What are you, a queer?" I've been called a sissy before, not by her, but by plenty of other people. That was different, though, as the word was less potent, something used by children. When my mother called me a queer, my face turned scarlet, and I exploded. "Me? What are you talking about? Why would you even say a thing like that?" Then I ran down to my room, which was spotless, everything just so. The Gustav Klimt posters on the walls, the cornflower blue vase I'd bought with the money I earned babysitting. The veil had been lifted, and now I saw this for what it was, the lair of a blatant homosexual. That would have been a good time as any to say, "Yes, you're right. Get me some help." But I was still hoping that it might be a phase, that I'd wake up the next day and be normal. In the best of times, it seemed like such a short leap. I did fantasize about having a girlfriend. Never the sex part, but the rest of it I had down. I knew what she'd look like and how she'd hold her long hair back from the flame when bending over a lit candle. I imagined us getting married the summer after I graduated from college, and then I imagined her drowning off the coast of North Carolina during one of my family's vacations. Everyone needed to be there so they could see just how devastated I was. I could actually make myself cry by picturing it, how I'd carry her out of the water, how my feet would sink into the sand owing to the extra weight. I'd try mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and keep trying until someone, my father most often, would pull me back saying, "It's too late, son. Can't you see she's gone?" It seemed I wanted to marry just so I could be a widower. So profound would be my grief that I'd never look at another woman again. It was perfect, really. Oh, there were variations. Sometimes she'd die of leukemia, as in the movie Love Story. Occasionally, a madman's bullet would fell her during a hostage situation, but always I'd be at her side, trying everything in my power to bring her back. The fantasy remained active until I was 20. Funny how unimportant being gay became once I told somebody. All I had to do was open up to my best friend, and when she accepted it, I saw that I could as well. "I just don't see why you have to rub everyone's noses in it," certain people would complain when I told them. Not that I wore it on T-shirts or anything. Rather, I'd just say boyfriend, the way they said wife or girlfriend or better half. I insisted that it was no different, and in time, at least in the circles I ran in, it became no different. While I often dreamed of making a life with another man, I never extended the fantasy to marriage or even to civil partnerships, which became legal in France in 1999, shortly after Hugh and I moved to Paris. We'd been together for 8 years by that point, and though I didn't want to break up or look for anyone else, I didn't need the government to validate my relationship. I felt the same way when a handful of American states legalized same-sex marriage, only more so. I didn't need a government or a church giving me its blessing. The whole thing felt like a step down to me. From the dawn of time, the one irrefutably good thing about gay men and lesbians was that we didn't force people to sit through our weddings. Even the most ardent of homophobes had to hand us that. We were the ones who toiled behind the scenes while straight people got married, the photographers and bakers and florists, working like Negro porters, settling spoiled passengers into the whites-only section of the train. "Oh, Christopher," a bride might sigh as her dressmaker zipped her up, "what would I have ever done without you?" What saved this from being tragic was that they were doing something we wouldn't dream of, guilt-tripping friends and relatives into giving up their weekends so they could sit on hard church pews or folding chairs in August, listening as the couple mewled vows at each other, watching as they were force-fed cake, standing on the sidelines, bored and sweating as the pair danced, misty-eyed, to a foreigner song. The battle for gay marriage was, in essence, the fight to be as square as straight people. To say things like, "My husband tells me that the new spicy Chipotle burger they've got at Bennigan's is awesome." That said, I was all for the struggle, mainly because it so irritated the fundamentalists. I wanted gay people to get the right to marry, and then I wanted none of us to act on it. I wanted it to be ours to spit on. Instead, much to my disappointment, we seemed to be all over it. I finally got a signal at the post office in the neighboring village. I'd gone to mail a set of keys to a friend, and afterward I went out front and pulled out my iPad. The touch of a finger, and there it was, the headline story on the New York Times site: "Supreme Court ruling makes same-sex marriage a right nationwide." I read it, and probably like every American gay person, I was overcome with emotion. Standing on the sidewalk, dressed in rags with a litter picker pinion between my legs, I felt my eyes tear up, and as my vision blurred, I considered all the people who had fought against this and thought, "Take that, assholes." The Supreme Court ruling tells every gay 15-year-old living out in the middle of nowhere that he or she is as good as any other dope who wants to get married. To me, it was a slightly mixed message, like saying we're all equally entitled to wear Dockers to the Olive Garden. Then I spoke to my accountant, who's as straight as they come, and he couldn't have been more excited. "For tax purposes, you and Hugh really need to act on this," he told me. "But I don't want to," I said. "I don't believe in marriage." He launched into a little speech, and here's the thing about legally defined couples. They save boatloads of money, especially when it comes to inheriting property. My accountant told me how much we had to gain, and I was like, "Is there a waiting period? What documents do I need?" That night, I proposed for the first of what eventually numbered 18 times. "Listen," I said to Hugh over dinner, "we really need to do this. Otherwise, when one of us dies, the other will be clobbered with taxes." "I don't care," he told me. "It's just money." This is a sentence that does not register on Greek ears. It's just a mango-sized brain tumor. It's just the person I hired to smother you in your sleep. But since when is money just money? "I'm not marrying you," he repeated. I swore to him that I was not being romantic about it. "There'll be no rings, no ceremony, no celebration of any kind. We won't tell anyone but the accountant. Think of it as a financial contract, nothing more." "No." "God damn it," I said, "you are going to marry me whether you like it or not." "No, I'm not." "Oh, yes, you are." After 2 weeks of this, he slammed his fork on the table, saying, "I'll do anything just to shut you up." This is, I'm pretty sure, the closest I'm likely to get to a yes. I took another ear of corn. "Fine, then. It's settled." It wasn't until the following day that the reality set in. I was out on the side of a busy road with my litter picker, collecting the shreds of a paper coffee cup that had been run over by a lawnmower, when I thought of having to tick the box that says married instead of single. I always thought there should have been another option, as for the past 24 years, I have been happily neither. I would never introduce Hugh as my husband, nor would he refer to me that way, but I can easily imagine other people doing it. They'd be the type who so readily embraced partner when it came down the pike in the mid-90s, well-meaning people, the kind who wear bike helmets. It occurred to me while standing there, cars whizzing by, that the day I marry is the day I'll get hit and killed, probably by some driver who's texting or, likelier still, sexting. He is survived by his husband, Hugh Hamrick, the obituary will read, and before I'm even in my grave, I'll be rolling over in it. That night at dinner, neither of us mentioned the previous evening's conversation. We talked about this and that, our little projects, the lives of our neighbors, and then we retreated to different parts of the house. Engaged, I suppose. Our whole lives ahead of us. The silent treatment. Aside from an occasional dinner party thrown by one of his neighbors, the only thing my father gets dressed up for anymore is church. When I was young, he'd drop my sisters and me off in time for Sunday school, then head to the club to play golf and return at the end of the service, most often after everyone else had left, and it was just us standing alone in front of the shuttered building. Now, though, he's there every week. "In a suit?" I asked. "Well, of course," he said. "What do you think?" It was late May, and he was sitting on the deck at the C-section, looking out at the ocean, which was relatively calm that day and topaz-colored. Lisa and Amy were at the table, too. Hugh had made us BLTs, and as he set them before us, my father rubbed his hands together. "Fantastic!" Even in his old age, he's a good-looking man. Skin still fairly taut, with a enviable, easy-to-draw nose, all straight line with no bumps. I'd love to have inherited it, but instead I resemble my mother, nostrils big enough to stuff olives into. He still has most of his hair, my father, some of it relatively dark. On this day, it was covered by a flat-top cap I'd bought him in London. It was made of cotton, with a bright pattern of small checks, and though when I gave it to him he claimed to hate it, he'd been wearing it since he arrived. "Why do you want to know what I wear to church?" he asked. I brought up a barbecue restaurant Hugh, Amy, and I had stopped at a few days earlier on our way from Raleigh to Emerald Isle. It was noon on Sunday in a small eastern North Carolina town. I figured that most everyone had come from church and found it interesting that the only men in jackets and ties were Mexican. The rest of them had Dockers on and polo shirts, I said. Women wore slacks as well. And? My father asked. It's just something I noticed, that's all. When we were young, we had to get dressed up. Now I hear that people are wearing shorts to church, and even sweatpants. My father winced. Well, not at the Holy Trinity. Before our church moved in the 1980s, it was in a stone building located in downtown Raleigh. The neighborhood was thought of as rough, at least by suburbanites like us. And though nothing bad ever happened, occasionally something exciting did. Say, Dad, remember the time you had a meeting with the priest and I went with you? Lisa asked. We were on our way back home when a black man exposed himself to us. I think I was 12 or 13, and he just pulled his penis right out of his pants and started waving it around. Oh, right. Our father wiped his mouth. I remember that like it was yesterday. Then you made a U-turn so we could see it again. He chuckled. It was big. Most fathers would shield their daughters from something like that, Lisa said, but there you were making sure I got a second look. Again, he laughed. I guess I saw it as an educational experience. I like it when Lisa and Hugh are around, as they can always get my father to talk. When it's just the two of us, I never know what to say. This is hardly a new development. It's been like this for as long as I can remember. All his life, my father has been handy. He worked on his own cars and once built an addition onto our house in Raleigh. My job always was to hand him tools as he called for them and to hold the work light, a bare bulb in an aluminum cage. It might have been different had I cared what a piston was or were I interested in the proper consistency of cement. As it was, I never asked and he never offered. Rather, I'd just stand there, my arm outstretched like a lawn jockey's. God damn it, quit moving. I'm not. Well, you sure as hell are, so stop it. I suppose I could have asked him questions about his job or his childhood, but it already seemed too late to get into it. These were the sorts of conversations that should have begun years earlier. They needed foundations built brick by brick and not just thwack down whole. He could have asked me about my life, but I don't know how articulate I would have been. What were you thinking slapping that beef roast with your bare hands? I don't know. I wasn't being cagey. I honestly hadn't a clue why I'd done it. The roast was on a serving tray, puddled in its own juices, juices that, when I hit it, spattered all over the pastel family portrait we'd sat for earlier that week at the mall. I watched the blood drip down our faces, and then I slapped the roast again, wondering all the while what had come over me. It was the same when I took an industrial stapler to our new kitchen countertops, an out-of-body experience. What do other fathers and sons talk about, I'd ask myself, shifting the work light from one hand to the other. There was never any problem making conversation with my mother. That was effortless, the topics springing from nowhere, and we'd move from one to the next in a way that made me think of a monkey gracefully swinging through the branches of a tree. The silence my father and I inflicted on each other back then is now exacerbated by his advanced age. Every time I see him could be the last, and the pressure I feel to make our conversation meaningful paralyzes me. How do you talk to him so easily? I asked Lisa as we carried the lunch dishes back into the house. It's simple, she told me. Sometimes I'll just call and say, hey, Dad, what are you up to? Watching Fox News while doing his taxes, no matter what month it is or what time of day, I said. Well, yes, but maybe he found a new deduction. Maybe someone from church died or one of his old neighbors. You never know. That night, we went to a restaurant Lisa and her husband Bob are fond of in the town of Atlantic Beach. I put on a shirt and tie. Amy debuted a new dress, and my father wore a T-shirt with white tennis shorts. His legs used to be hairy, but now they're as smooth as a child's, the result, he says, of wearing knee-high socks for all those years at IBM. He rode to the restaurant with Hugh and me and perked up when, halfway through the 20-minute drive, we passed the condominium complex we often stayed at in the 1980s. "Hey," he said, "that's where we used to go when we were a family." "Well, aren't you still a family?" Hugh asked. "I meant when Sharon was alive." Though I hated hearing him say that, I couldn't deny the truth of it. Our mother was the one who held us all together. After her death, we were like a fistful of damp soil, loose bits breaking off with no one to press them back in. When she was around, we came to the beach every year. The place we just passed was set in a complex of 20 or so units arranged around a pool. There are pictures of us all standing on the deck, my eyes and those of several of my sisters bloodshot from all our pot smoking. I think of the meth-fueled sandcastles we built, and the dinosaurs made of driftwood the year we could afford cocaine. "You're all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed," our mother used to say when we'd returned from our midnight walks on the beach. She knew what was up, while I don't think our father had a clue. The condo we rented was arranged over 5 floors. When my sisters brought boyfriends, they had to sleep in separate rooms. It was the same at my parents' place in Raleigh. "It's my house, so you play by my rules," our mother used to say. The sole exception was me, for some reason. I said to my father not long ago, "The only sex you and Mom allowed under your roof was gay sex. Didn't that seem odd to you?" "Well, there was us," he said. "Us? I mean your mother and me." I covered my ears and vomited a little in my mouth. The restaurant in Atlantic Beach resembled a shack, so I was surprised by the fancy menu, which was handed out by a young, bow-lipped woman with a sweet, eastern North Carolina accent. "I'd like to start with the women, if that's okay," she said, when it came time to take our orders. She turned to Lisa. "So what will you be having this evening, m'lady?" It was such an unexpected word, so refined, and Amy repeated it all night. "How were your 5 double scotches, m'lady?" When our food arrived, I mentioned a flight attendant I'd recently met. I was asking her about the things passengers leave behind on planes, and she told me that earlier that week she discovered a used Kotex in one of the seat backs. "Oh, my God," Amy said, delighted. "And it was still warm," I added. My father looked down at his flounder. "Is that any way to talk at the table?" "He's disgusting," Hugh said, happy to have found something he and my father could agree on. I then brought up a fellow I'd met in New Mexico who has an uncle named Phil McCracken. "What's wrong with that?" my father asked. "Phil my crack in," Lisa said. "Get it? Like butt crack?" My father sighed. "The level of discourse here is definitely lacking." "So tell me, Lou," Hugh said, "what was your father like?" He was trying to open things up a bit and didn't realize that, subject-wise, he'd steered us onto a dead-end street. My grandfather, the man we addressed as Papu, died when I was 6 years old. He came from Greece, as did Yaya, my grandmother. Neither of them spoke more than 100 words of English, yet they owned and ran a newsstand in Cortland, New York. The space was long and dim and narrow, like a hallway that led to nothing, lit by a bare bulb. They lived in the small apartment upstairs, and though I can picture it clearly, all I remember about Papu is that he was short, 5'1", according to his immigration papers. "Why are you asking about my father?" my father said. Hugh shrugged. "I've just never heard that much about him." My father signaled the waitress for another vodka tonic. "Well, he was a very hard worker." "You're not going to get any more than that out of him," Lisa said to Hugh. "Believe me, we've been trying all our lives." I never told my father, but a few years earlier, I'd received a letter from an 82-year-old woman in Cortland. She said some nice things about my books, then added, "Your grandfather was a pig." Then it was just her name. No best wishes or anything. "I have nothing more to tell you," my father said when Hugh asked for details. "The man worked very hard. Both my parents did. There wasn't time for anything else." It's maddening how tight-lipped he is on the subject. Greeks tend to disapprove when their children marry outside the culture, so Papu was a real dick to my mother. She'd shudder at the mention of his name, but never got specific, saying only, "You'll have to take that up with your father." "How can you not have a single memory of him?" I asked later that night on our way home from the restaurant. "I mean, there has to be something you recall. Did he drive a car? Did he ever listen to music or read? I remember Yaya saying some pretty rough things about black people, which is odd given her limited vocabulary. It's like she took English lessons from a Klan member but quit after the second day. Was he that way too? Did he smoke? Did he give you Christmas presents?" "He's asleep," Hugh told me. "What?" "Your dad. He's asleep." The next morning, I saw my father at the dining room table, leafing through a magazine Bob had brought. It was about North Carolina crafts and had a salad bowl on the cover. "Hey," he cried, looking up as I came down the stairs. "There he is." Lisa entered at around the same time, saying, "How you doing, Dad?" "Fantastic." It is my habit to write in the morning, so I made a pot of coffee and carried it up to the room Hugh and I share. My work table is in a corner beside a sliding glass door that looks out onto the ocean, and I'd been sitting at it for an hour or so when my father wandered in. This is something he's done since I was a child. I'd be at my desk, drawing or doing homework, and he'd come in and stretch out on the bed. "What's going on?" he'd ask. A minute later, he'd be fast asleep. This continued after I moved out and had my own apartment on the other side of Raleigh. He'd walk in without knocking and go straight to my bed, almost urgently, as if it were a toilet he desperately needed to use. "So what's going on?" my father asked, hands on his hips, looking out my sliding glass door at the ocean. "Nothing," I said, "just trying to get some work done." He sat on the edge of the bed and tested it, the way you might if you were shopping for a new mattress. I noticed that his feet barely touched the floor, and as he lifted them in order to stretch out, I turned back to my computer and finished a letter I was writing to a convict. I get a lot of mail from people in prison, both men and women. They rarely say what they're in for, but what with the internet, it's easy enough to find out. Drugs, in this case. "So how you doing?" my father asked. "How's your health?" This was possibly the 10th time in 2 days that he'd asked me this question. "Fine. You feeling pretty good?" "I guess." I can see him doing the same thing I am, trying to make some sort of connection. We're like a pair of bad trapeze artists, reaching for each other's hands and missing every time. Meanwhile, the stage crew has gathered below us and begun to roll up the safety net. "Thank you for dinner last night," my father said. "That was awfully generous of you." "It was my pleasure." I returned my attention to the letter I was writing and wondered who might be the first to read it. Someone must surely open the envelopes before they get to the inmates, searching for money and easy-to-hide drugs. By the time I turned back to my father, he was snoring, which was for the best, probably. Growing up, I never got the sense that he particularly liked me. I didn't feel completely unloved. If the house were on fire, he would have dragged me out, though it would have been after he rescued everyone else. It could have been worse, at least I had my mother. But as a child, it really bothered me. What can I do to make him like me, I used to wonder. The harder I tried to mold myself into the sort of son I thought he wanted, the more contemptuous he became. And so, eventually, I quit trying and founded the opposition party, which I still lead to this day. Whatever he's for, I'm against. Almost. Watching my father asleep on my bed, I thought again of the pastel family portrait I'd ruined. If that were an isolated incident, I might have a right to my self-pity. But if I'm honest about it, I wouldn't have liked my childhood self either. I regularly lied and stole money from him. If there was silence in the car, I'd break it by making one of my sisters cry. "Dad, David keeps saying I'm pregnant and that the baby will have a cat's body and be born dead. I never did too, did not, liar." For a while, when I was 11 or so, I used to drop the empty cardboard toilet rolls into the John. They would take a while to disappear, 5 or 6 flushes usually, but I was in no hurry. The first 3 times the toilet clogged, my father went at it with the plunger, and that did the trick. Then, for some reason, the plunger wasn't enough. He ordered me to get his toolbox and to stand in the open doorway, ready to hand him whatever he called for. After draining the tank and turning off the water supply, he used his wrench on the lug nuts and unmoored the toilet from the floor, exposing a foul, corroded, fist-sized hole that stunk up the entire house. I held my breath and watched as he reached down into it and withdrew part of the roll I had flushed a few hours earlier. Who in the hell? That night there was a big lecture at the dinner table. When I get my hands on whoever's doing this. He didn't even use a glove, I thought, watching as he took a piece of bread from the wicker basket we had. A few nights later, I flushed another empty roll down the John, which clogged again. Out came the plunger, the tools, orders to stand in the doorway. The toilet was lifted off the floor, and as my father cursed and rolled up his sleeves, I must have laughed, or at least smiled in some telltale way. "You," he growled, looking up at me from his kneeling position on the floor, "you're the one who's doing this. Me? Don't even try to talk your way out of it." I offered some lame denial. "I hardly ever even go to the bathroom. You should ask Amy or Tiffany. They're the ones. You are going to reach down into this pipe and pick out that cardboard roll," my father said. "Then you are never going to flush anything but toilet paper down this toilet again." As I backed away, he pounced. Then he wrestled me to the floor, grabbed my hand, and forced it deep into what amounted to my family's asshole. And there it has been ever since, sorting through our various shit. It's like I froze in that moment, with the same interests as that 11-year-old boy, the same maturity level, the same haircut, the same glasses, even. What I remember more vividly than the stench and the sight of my hand when I pulled it out of that terrible pipe was how strong my father was. I'd put up the fight of my life, but might as well have been a doll the way he wrenched apart my folded arms and took me by the wrist. I couldn't imagine being that powerful. He's slighter now, of course, shorter by a few inches and downright skinny, arms and legs no thicker than the bones beneath them. How was I ever afraid of this person, I wondered now, watching his narrow chest as it rose and fell. "David," he used to shout from the top of the stairs, "get up here. What did I do?" I'd call from my room, certain he'd found me out for something. "Whatever it wasn't me. Get up here now." Half the time it would be trouble. He'd discovered the branches ripped off the tree he'd just planted, or the football he gave me melted on the hibachi. But just as likely, he'd be in the living room, and music would be playing. It was always jazz, most often something on the radio. My father's most prized possession was his stereo system, which he housed in a glass-doored cabinet, turntable, amplifier, fancy tape deck, all of it top of the line and off limits to the rest of us. "Sit down," he'd say, gesturing to the couch. "I want you to listen to this. I mean, really listen." I knew a guy in high school, Tietzel, who'd do the same thing. "There's a song you have to check out," he'd insist, taking Born to Run or some LP by The Who out of its jacket, filling his bedroom with the pleasant stink of new record. Though I'd pretend otherwise, wow, great. Nothing Tietzel played ever moved me or made me feel any better about the world I was living in. My dad, though, the things he exposed me to blew my mind. "Who is this?" I'd ask. "Never mind that now. Just listen." He tried doing the same to my sisters and my brother Paul, but none of them ever heard what he and I did. John Coltrane's I Wish I Knew, Betty Carter singing Beware My Heart. The hair on my arms would stand up, and everything else would recede. My shitty life at school, the loneliness and self-loathing I worried every day might drag me under, all of it replaced by unspeakable beauty. Are you getting this? He'd ask, his hands balled into fists the way a coach's might be, pacing the room as I listened. Afterward, spent, he'd turn down the volume, and we'd share that rare silence that was companionable rather than tense. This was what we had in common. Music. When he was growing up, jazz was the equivalent of rap or punk rock. Listening to it meant something. It made you a certain kind of person, especially to parents whose best-loved instrument was a bouzouki. I don't imagine Papu could have distinguished Miles Davis from a passing dump truck. It was all just noise to him. That might have been part of its appeal to my father, but it had nothing to do with mine. Music is the only way I didn't rebel against him. Sitting in the silent afterglow of a song he'd just ordered me to listen to, I'd imagine myself on stage, sweat-drenched at the piano like Oscar Peterson, or perhaps I was the headlining trumpet player or guitarist taking a bow. The audience before me would be going wild with appreciation, though one person in particular would stand out, my father, on his feet, cheering. Did you hear that? That's my son up there. There was a baby grand piano just outside the bedroom I occupied until I left for college, and I'd strike the keys from time to time, imagining how proud I could make him by buckling down and really learning how to play. By the age of 12, though, I knew a setup when I saw one. There's an expression you often hear from recovering alcoholics, "Don't go to the hardware store for milk." If I were to master an instrument or do anything creative with my life, I'd have to do it for myself and myself only. As an adult, I regularly returned to Raleigh and read out loud at what used to be Memorial Auditorium but is now part of the Duke Energy Center. My family will attend, and afterward, without fail, my father will say, "That was nice and everything, but it wasn't sold out." "Well, actually it was," I'll tell him. "No, it wasn't," he'll say. "While waiting for you to walk out on stage, I counted 30 empty seats." This is him all over. The place accommodates more than 2,200 people, but all he can see are the unoccupied chairs. As a rule, 5% of concertgoers who buy their tickets 6 months or more in advance either forget to show up or make other plans in the meantime, I'll tell him, quoting my friend Adam, who started producing events 30 years ago and knows what he's talking about. "That's not true," my father will say. "Those seats weren't forgotten. They were empty." This is as if a marked disinterest in me had turned them a different color. "Okay," I'll say, thinking, who does this? Goes to the shows of people they're supposed to be proud of and counts the empty seats. Were I playing the piano to a packed house at the Monterey Jazz Festival, it would be no different. "Where the hell was everyone?" he'd ask when my set was over. He takes a lot of naps now, my father, 2 or 3 a day by my count, at least when we're all together at the beach. In 20 or so minutes, he'd wake up, recharged. And though I wanted to join the action downstairs, I didn't want him to wake up in an empty room. There was nothing to do but wait, I supposed. And in the meantime, I'd put together a playlist we could listen to. A little Jessica Williams, followed by Sam Jones and Eddie Higgins. People he might not have heard lately. A bill guaranteed to really shut us up for a while. Untamed. Aside from Peter, who supposedly guards the gates of heaven, and is a pivotal figure in any number of jokes. The only saint who's ever remotely interested me is Francis of Assisi, who was friends with the animals. I recall pictures of him, birds perched on his shoulders and his outstretched hands, deer at his feet, maybe a cougar in the background looking on and thinking, there are some birds and deer I can kill, but wait, who's he? Creatures gravitated to St. Francis because they recognized something in him, a quality that normal men lacked. Let that be me, I used to wish when I was 10 and felt so desperately alone. There'd usually be a hamster clutched tight in my fist, trying with all his might to escape instead of resting companionably in my palm the way he was supposed to. Skip ahead 50 years. It's late summer in West Sussex, and I'm seated on the patio outside the converted stable I use as my office. It might be midnight or 2 a.m. I've brought out a lamp and set it on the table in front of me. To a casual observer, I'm tabulating receipts or writing letters. But what I'm really doing is waiting, almost breathlessly, for Carol. I grew up in the suburbs of Raleigh, North Carolina, so didn't see a fox until I moved to France in 1998. There were plenty of them in Normandy, and every so often I'd come upon one, usually at dusk. It was hard to get a good look at them, since they'd run the moment they saw me, not as if they were frightened, but as if they were guilty. This had to do with their heads and the way they were hanging, and their eyes, which were watchful but at the same time averted. In Sussex, too, foxes are common, though most of the ones I come upon are dead, hit by cars and rotting by the side of the road. The first time Hugh and I visited the area in 2010, we stayed with our friends Viv and Gretchen, who live in the village of Sutton. They'd roasted a chicken for dinner, and when we finished eating, Viv threw the carcass into the yard, for whoever wants it, he said. When we got our own house, not far from theirs, we started doing the same thing, tossing our bones into the meadow our backyard opens onto. Whatever we put out vanishes by morning, but who or what took it is anyone's guess. We have badgers, but as with foxes, you're more apt to come across them dead than alive. Occasionally I'll see a hedgehog on our property, Galveston, his name is, and there's no shortage of deer and quail. We have pheasants and stoats and so many rabbits that in the spring and summer it looks as if our house is a backdrop for an Easter commercial. One of the reasons I don't want a cat is that it will kill our wildlife. My brother has to change his doormat every 2 months. That's how much his savages drag home. And my sister Gretchen's are just as bad. She's forever returning from work to find a chipmunk on her sofa, its head chewed to a paste, or a bird that's not quite dead, flapping the stump that used to be a wing against her blood-spattered kitchen floor. Another argument against pets, at least for Hugh and me, are the fights they lead to. In the mid-90s, we got 2 cats, the last of 30, owned by the actress Sandy Dennis, who had recently died of ovarian cancer and who had lived in a house in Connecticut that, on a summer day, you could smell from our apartment in Soho. Angel and Baratos were black with white spots, both short-haired. We changed their names to Sandy and Dennis, and from the day they entered our lives until the day they died, Hugh and I fought over how to feed and care for them. I'm of the let's fatten you up until you're too obese to do much of anything, school, while he's more practical or mean, as I'm apt to call it. You don't know what it's like living in a small apartment day and night with nothing to look forward to, I used to say. All they live for is food, so why not give it to them? This healthy pet nonsense, I just don't buy it. I can't tell you how many times I've gone to a neighbor with a bag of leftovers only to be told that their dog doesn't do table scraps, and Bones, no way, he could choke. These are the same people who avoid canned food in favor of dry nuggets that remain in the bowl, ignored for days at a time, but are, I'm told, so much better for him than that other stuff. I once knew someone in New York who insisted that his black lab was a vegetarian. Just like you, I said. Gosh, what a coincidence. When the dog charged after a hamburger somebody had dropped on the sidewalk outside a McDonald's on 8th Avenue, he was, I guess, just going after the pickle. Then there are all the behavioral arguments that joint pet ownership leads to. Don't let her jump up on the table / countertop / stereo, etc. As if you can stop a cat from going where she likes. That's why you want them 15 pounds overweight. It keeps them lower to the ground. Sandy was old and died a year after we got her. We brought Dennis to France when we left New York and shuttled him between the house in Normandy and the apartment in Paris. This led to regular fights over how to get him into his cat carrier and how often to let him outside. When he died, we fought over where to bury him and how deep. All I can say is, thank God we never had children. We even fight about the creatures I drag home, things I find most often on my walks, and wrap up in a handkerchief. They're usually mice or shrews, already doomed, though not by anything obvious. They haven't been run over. There are never any teeth marks on them. Perhaps they're diseased or just too old to run away from me. You're not giving it croutons, are you? You will say. It is named Canfield, and I'm not forcing him to eat anything, I'll answer, dropping what will look like a fistful of dice into the terrarium, or, if that's already in use as a hospice for some dying toad or vole, my backup bucket. They're just there if he wants them. On to this battleground, Carol arrived. It's the funniest thing, Hugh said one evening in mid-July. I had the kitchen door open earlier, and this little fox walked by, looked in at me, and continued on her way, not running, not in any hurry. She looks to me like she might be named Carol. The next afternoon, I threw a steak bone into the pasture, and at dusk, I glanced out and saw a fox with it in her mouth. Hugh, I called, come look. At the sound of my voice, the fox, most certainly the Carol I'd been hearing about, returned the bone to the ground, the way you might if you were caught trying to shoplift something. I was just seeing how heavy this was, she seemed to say, before taking off. The following night we ate chicken at the table on the patio outside my office. It was dusk, and just as we finished, there was Carol. One of the things I've come to appreciate is that you never see her coming. Rather, she simply appears. When she reached a distance of 6 feet or so, I threw her the bones off my plate. What are you doing? Hugh hissed as she commenced eating them. Here we go, I thought. Once a week during this past summer, I'd stay awake all night, tying up loose ends. I liked the way I was left feeling at dawn, not tired, but just the opposite, speedy, almost, and brilliant. Not long after the chicken dinner, I was working at my outdoor table when, at around 4 a.m., Carol showed up. We had no meat in the refrigerator, but she waited while I found some cheese and opened the tin of sardines. Foxes often bury their food, saving it for later. I thought that meant a day or two, but apparently there's nothing they consider too spoiled. Rotten is acceptable, as is putrid. Since we met Carol, our backyard has become a graveyard for pork chops and beef jerky and raw chicken legs. What's this? Hugh demanded not long ago. He was on his knees in a flower bed, a trowel in one hand, and what looked like a desiccated thumb in the other. I squinted in his direction. Half a hot dog? He was furious. What are you doing? Foxes don't want junk like this. Hot dogs are disgusting. Not to someone who eats maggots, I said. He claims that I'm manipulating Carol. That's you, the puppet master. It's the same way you are with people, constantly trying to buy them. He's under the impression that the occasional chicken carcass is enough, that anything else will spoil Carol, will, in fact, endanger her. Believe me, she was just fine before you came along. But was she? Really? It's a hard life out there for a fox. Yes, there are rabbits and birds around, but they don't surrender easily. According to the websites I visited, Carol's diet consists mainly of beetles and worms. There's an occasional mouse, an insect larva, maybe some roadkill, just awful-tasting stuff. And I'm willing to bet that all those same websites advise against feeding wild animals, you said. Well, not all of them, I told him. They do discourage hand-feeding, not because you'll be bitten, but because, once tame, the fox is likely to approach your neighbor, who may not be as receptive to his or her company as you are. I can see how that might be a problem in America, where everyone has a gun. But in England, what are you going to do? Stab Carol to death? Good luck getting that close, because the only person she really trusts is me. You should see the way she follows me to the garden bench, almost as if she were a dog, but at the same time cat-like, nimble, her tail straight out and bobbing slightly as she walks. Then she'll lie on the grass at my feet, her paws crossed, and look at me for a second before turning away. Carol's uncomfortable, making eye contact. A shame, as hers have the brilliance of freshly minted pennies. From nose to tail, her coloring is remarkable, the burnt orange fading to what looks like a white bib protecting her chest, then darkening from rust to black on her front legs, which resemble spent matchsticks. Because I give her only the best ground beef and free-range chicken, her coat is full, not mangy, like those other foxes. Carol has come as close as 2 inches from my hand, but I have to look away as she approaches. Again, it's the eye contact thing. In pictures, she looks like a stuffed animal, and oh, I show them to everyone. Have you seen my fox? No? Hold on while I get my phone. In my favorite photograph, she's outside the kitchen door. It's around 7 in the evening, still light, and you can see her perfectly just sitting there. It's actually Hugh who took the picture, so the expression on her face says, "Yes, but where's David?" The response to my photo is wonderment, tinged with envy. How come I don't have a Carol? Unless, of course, the person I'm speaking to is small-minded. A lot of small-minded people out where we live raise chickens. Horrible, brutal things, foxes, they say. Once one gets into the henhouse, it'll kill everything in sight just for the hell of it. The charge was repeated in the comment section of a YouTube video I watched one night about a vixen named Tammy that was hit by a car and healed by a veterinarian who later released her back into the wild. I know how much people love to save wildlife, but how would you feel if a fox killed your chickens or turkey? Someone named Pat Stokes asked. To this, a man responded, "My chickens are cunts." I don't know if this made him pro-fox, or if he was just stating the facts. If I had to badmouth Carol, my one complaint would be her sense of humor. "You are so serious," I often tell her. I'd add that she never grows any more comfortable in my presence. She seems to me very English in her awkwardness. "Then stop making her uncomfortable," Hugh says. He thinks that instead of feeding her on the patio outside my office, I should leave her food in the field and let her eat it on her own time. The first problem with that suggestion is slugs. I thought I knew them from my youth in Raleigh, but the slugs of North America are nothing compared to their British cousins. They're like walruses in Sussex, long and fat from eating everything Hugh tries to grow that the rabbits and deer happen to miss. I've seen them feast on the viscous bodies of their stepped-on relatives, so when something decent is presented, pork shoulder, say, or a fresh lamb kidney, they go wild, and we must have, no exaggeration, at least 12 million slugs on our 2-acre property. Galveston, the hedgehog, keeps their numbers down, as do 2 toads, Lane and Courtney, but it's a losing battle. The second problem with throwing food into the pasture is one of perception. It would allow Carol to feel, if not like a huntress, then at least like a successful scavenger. "Look what I found," she'd think. This as opposed to, "Look what David gave me." I insist that Carol eat in my presence for the same reason I wait for the coffee shop employee to turn back in my direction before putting a tip in his basket. I want to be acknowledged as a generous provider. This is about me, not them. I don't need Hugh to point out how ridiculous this is. Wild animals do not give a damn about our little feelings. They're incapable of it. I love you, I love you, I love you, we say. What they hear is senseless noise. It's like us trying to discern emotion in the hum of a hairdryer, or the chortle of an engine as it fails to turn over. That's the drawback, but also the glory of creatures that were never domesticated. Nothing feels better than being singled out by something that should at best fear you and at worst would like to eat you. I think of the people I've known over the years who found a baby raccoon or possum and brought it home to raise it. When young, the animals were sweet. Then one day they became moody and violent, like human teenagers, but with claws and sharp, pointy teeth. It was their wildness reclaiming them. After the change, it was back into their cages, their heartsick owners, jailers now, watching as they tore at the bars, never tiring of it, thinking only of escape. But wait, we tell ourselves, always wanting to project, to anthropomorphize, to turn the story in our favor. But what about this? One night in late September, as I was walking home in the dark from the neighboring village, I felt a presence next to me. A dog, I wondered. But the footsteps I heard were daintier, and I wasn't near any houses. I keep a flashlight in my backpack, so I turned it on, and there was Carol. "Is this where you are when I call for you at 2 in the morning? I asked. There was a canopy of leaves over my head. Once I moved beyond it, the moon lit my path, so I turned off the flashlight. I'd expected Carol to be gone by that point, but for the next half mile, all the way home, she walked with me, sometimes by my side and sometimes a few steps ahead, leading the way. No cars approached or passed. The road was ours, and we marched right down the center of it, all the way to the front of the house and through the garden gate to the kitchen door. I didn't know it then, but this would be the last time I would see Carol. Foxes are like gang members. They can't go wherever they like. That next patch of land is someone else's territory, so chances are she was killed somehow. If she'd been hit by a car, I'd have seen her body by the side of the road, but maybe she dragged herself off into the woods and died there. She could have been poisoned, which happens. Hunters pay good money to bag the pheasant that are released here every fall. These are birds that, honestly, you have to work not to kill. The landowners want to protect their investments, which means keeping down the predators. That's likely what happened to Carol, Hugh says. I know this makes sense, but I refuse to hear it. She's just taking a little break, I think, trying to establish her independence, which is normal for someone her age. I still call for her when I step into the yard at night. Still look into the shadows for some hint of movement, waiting to change my tone from the voice you use when summoning someone to the less plaintive and much more preferable one you use to welcome them back home. The Ones Who Got Away. It was a Friday night in mid-July around 9 o'clock, and Hugh and I were at the dinner table eating the spaghetti he makes with sausage in it. We'd been together for almost 3 decades, and for some reason I'd waited until this moment to ask how many people he'd slept with before we became a couple. Hugh looked at the ceiling, which is crisscrossed with beams and, to my great consternation, spider webs. I'm vigilant, really I am, but out in the country there's no keeping up with them. So, I said, I'm thinking, he told me. I used to know how many people I'd slept with. After meeting Hugh, though, I took myself off the market, and the figure faded from memory. If I were to slog through all my old diaries, I could certainly retrieve it, 28, 30. Do I include those early gropings? They felt significant at the time, but do they qualify as sex if you never took your clothes off or actually touched anything with your bare hands? I wanted to ask Q, but he was too busy counting. 32, 33. I put down my fork. You're not finished yet? Shh, he said. You're making me lose